Okay, it is August 4th, 2010. My name is Chris Seifer. I'm with the FCIC, and we are interviewing Mr. Daryl Doko of the OTS. And Mr. Chris Sturbens of the OTS is also on the line. Mr. Doko, with me here in this conference room are some of my colleagues, including Claire Moraine, Carl McCardin, Tom Stanton, Al Crego. Chris or Daryl, let me know if you need spellings and all those names, and we'll get them to you down the road or at the end
maybe,
of this conversation.
Maybe Chris Sturbridge can just email it to me.
Sure. Mr. Doko, as I was telling you before we threw on the tape recorder, we're all with the FCIC. We were created by a statute passed last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009, and that statute tells us to figure out the causes of the financial crisis in a year. And so that's what we're trying to do. That statute tells us to look at various categories of potential contributing causes and to also look at any institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of substantial government assistance. Countrywide does not fall into that category because of the B of A acquisition. But it does tell us to look at, for example, the role of securitization, the role of the increase in non-traditional mortgage product, the role of regulation. So, you know, that is why we are, amongst other things, you know, looking at Countrywide, and that is why we wanted to talk to you since you worked at the OTS, and the OTS had the pleasure of regulating Countrywide from March 2007 when they flipped their charter. So before we get into the substance of Countrywide, could you please, just so we have it for the record, summarize your educational and work background, starting with college?
Sure. I did undergraduate with a BA in finance at the University of Washington. Did a Master's of Business Administration from the University of Oregon. Then joined the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. That was in 1972, and my MBA actually was officially, given to me in 73. I worked at the OCC for 13 years, rising through the ranks from the field examiner position to an office position to Washington, D.C., where I held several positions. The most recent before I left the OCC was the Assistant Chief National Bank Examiner, where I had responsibility for examination policies for commercial exams, consumer exams, bank accounting matters, and there's something else there, commercial, consumer, bank accounting. Oh, and EDP, or at that time it was called EDP, it's now Information Services Exams. Well, at the OCC, I was able to do a fellowship at JFK School of Government at Harvard, where I got my Master's of Public Administration. In approximately the summer of 1985, I joined the Federal Home Loan Bank of Seattle and became the Executive Vice President, Senior Vice President for Supervision, and eventually had all supervision examination for the Federal Home Loan Bank Board System of the Seattle Bank. During that time period, I had some temporary assignments, for example, acting as Director of Mergers and Acquisitions for the FSLIC. Eventually, the Federal Home Loan Bank System collapsed with the legislation of FERIA, and then I joined the Office of Thrift Supervision in 1989. And was working in Washington at the time of that transition, moved back to the Seattle area, and then worked in the office, worked as an examiner in the field, assistant director, deputy director, and eventually in September 2007 became the regional director for the West region.
And I'm sorry, I just wasn't writing fast enough. What was the date when you became regional director?
September 2007.
Okay. And do you recall when you became deputy director?
It was approximately 2005.
Okay. That's fine. You were deputy director when, in March of 07, and when the when the OTS approved the charter, and earlier in 06 when I guess they originally approached the OTS about flipping charters. Correct?
Yes, right. I was one of two deputies in the region myself at Edward Channel.
Right, right. And if I remember correctly, was that followed Chuck Dierdorf's retirement, right? Is that right? Or is that wrong?
I think that is correct. I'm trying to, let me just pause for a minute and put this, it was Patriarch.
Chuck followed Mike, I know that.
Okay, so well, Eric Shand was there for a while, and then John Robinson was there.
Right.
So the order is anyway, the regional directors were Robinson, Patriarca, Shand may have been acting for a while, mm-hmm. and then Dierdorf, and then Finn.
That's right, right.
And then Doko.
Mm-hmm. Right, 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 okay. Okay, so... and I guess just take me to the end. So regional director in September of 07. Are you still at the OTS?
I retired in March of 2009.
And you're still retired today, I take it?
Yes.
Congratulations. Okay. So let's go... To the issue of Countrywide. Now, let me tell you what I do know, and then generally I'm going to ask you to initially tell us about your involvement with that institution. Like I said earlier, we know that the charter gets approved in March of 07, and we've heard conflicting reports about when Countrywide initially contacts the OTS about, you know, possibly doing that. Some folks saying as far back as 05. But could you just tell us, you know, when was your first involvement with Countrywide?
Dates are hard for me at this stage, but you might be able to help me refresh as I go through here, Chris. Countrywide had approached the OTS about a possible conversion for its bank. And so it was, I'm guessing, at least 3 months before the application and approval. They originally, I think, approached Washington, D.C., and then basically Scott Polakoff took the lead, and then Mike Finn in the region. And a series of meetings were set up, and probably 4 or 5 meetings, maybe even more. And I was invited to join probably 2 of those meetings.
Okay. If it helps, and I don't know, the timing is hugely important, but I think the application was actually submitted in December, and I think March 12th is the approval order. So you think maybe sometime in the fall of 06, you know, that's when these...
Yeah, my sense was the application wasn't submitted for probably 1 to 3 months before the initial contact.
Okay, and so these two meetings that you were participating in, I guess the first question is, where were those meetings?
They were at Countrywide.
Okay.
My memory is that Scott Polakoff and Mike Finn, and it could be in the initial meeting, even Director Rich, met with them. And then there was a series of questions that came out of that, and a series of follow-up meetings. And so Mike Finn and Scott Polakoff selected, based on the topics, who should be at subsequent meetings. And so I know I attended at least 2, if I remember correctly, and possibly more, but I think I did not attend all of them. I know that for sure.
Okay. Do you know if during these the meetings, at least you went to, were did the OTS like prepare notes of those meetings, or were there minutes of those meetings, or anything like that, or memos, you know, prepared after the fact about we had this meeting and here's the stuff we learned and what we have to follow up on, et cetera, et cetera.
There were clearly some emails with some of the issues that came out of the meetings. I know we had conversations in the region with Mike Finn as to what the next steps would be and who should be prepared to go down and what the topics would be. So clearly there's emails. I'm not sure about formal. I don't think there was like memos and minutes as such, but there were emails.
So why? What was your understanding of why Countrywide wanted to switch to a thrift charter from a bank charter?
Well, I have a distinct memory of Angela Mozilla telling us that answer, at least the answer he gave us. And it was, you know, the Fed EIC at the time was meeting with him and basically told him he didn't know why he had a thrift charter. Why he didn't have a thrift charter, that really his operation was more aligned to a thrift, and he thought it should be a thrift holding company and operate the bank as a thrift. So that prompted Mr. Mozilla to apparently start doing some inquiries, and I'm of the impression, or else I was told, that he actually contacted Mike Perry at IndyMac to see what Mike Perry thought about the OTS. And all that then transpired into Countrywide beginning to do due diligence as to what charter would make the most sense for it in the long run, given its operations and its aspirations. And so that's, I believe, why they contacted OTS eventually to figure out if a charter made sense.
And when Mr. Mozilla, this was in a meeting that you were in?
I remember him repeating that in a meeting I was in. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
He credited, I'm trying to think of the FRB's examiner, Stan Crisp. He credited Stan Crisp with giving him the idea and motivating him to explore the thrift charter.
Okay. Any other reasons communicated by Mr. Mozilla?
Not that I remember.
Let me ask you if this jogs any memory bells. You know, we've seen in some OCC documents, who of course were the primary regulators before they flipped, you know, documents telling Countrywide, that a matter requiring attention, which is, you know, the phraseology the OCC uses, was that they needed to change the way they were ordering appraisals. It had to be more of an independent function. And there have been reports in the press and otherwise that this was a bone of contention between the OCC and Countrywide, and that the OTS would not require that, and that may have also been a reason for Countrywide looking to get out from the National Bank Charter and into the Thrift Charter. So, of course, my initial question is, did you ever hear anything like that?
Yeah, I actually have some memories of that situation, and it's not, I don't remember it the way you just characterized it.
Tell me how you do.
The OCC had an issue with the ordering of appraisals, and the Fed also looked at the issue. So it wasn't a reason, I don't believe, for filing an application to convert, but it was an issue. For example, they may or may not go forward with their application, depending upon whether the OTS and the Fed would be consistent, or would we be consistent with the OCC. And so the issue was raised to the OTS in one of the meetings, and it was really raised as a point of inquiry, not a point of we won't convert without an answer that is one we like. So I don't think it was ever hinged upon conversion. It was more hinged as part of the due diligence. What would be the position of this? And so they raised the issue. The OTS, Scott Polakoff and Mike Finn, took it to Washington, D.C. appraisal experts and then the regional appraisal expert and asked Countrywide for clarifying information. And they sat down and went through the USPAP stuff, looked at the OCC and the Fed positions. And my memory is that after research and after assertions and confirmations from Countrywide, the OTS agreed with the Fed position. and which was then different from the OCC position, and actually gave Countrywide something to that effect, that said if all the representations are true and if in fact it's done the way it's portrayed, we would agree with the Fed. So that's my memory of it.
Go ahead.
It wasn't an issue linked to the conversion, I don't think.
Right. Now, I don't have it in front of me, but I'm assuming that the March 12, 2007 order approving the charter, those things tend to have conditions in them. Do you recall if anything about this issue we're talking about, this independent appraisal order, was part of that, or was it in a separate writing, do you think?
I think it's in a separate. I don't remember the approval very well, but I do have the impression, based on my recollection, that there were separate communications on the appraisal issue.
Okay. Let me ask, and then I take it... Okay, wait, actually, we've covered that. Never mind. Now, another thing we've heard in terms of Countrywide seeking the thrift charter, both it was... frankly, reported in the press, and as we've heard from, frankly, other folks we've talked to that are with the OTS, was that Countrywide may have believed the OTS was an easier regulator than the OCC. Did that issue come up in discussion with the folks at Countrywide? Have you heard that before?
Never. In fact, it was insulting when it got kind of parlayed in the in the press and alluded to, I think, once by the OCC. It never came up, the issue. What was obvious, though, was that the OTS was giving Countrywide its highest executives as an audience. And that's something that I don't think Countrywide felt the OCC ever did. So clearly, Countrywide, in my view, saw that the OTS was going to be a regulator that would listen, make its own decisions, and then go accordingly. It was not seeking an easier regulator. It clearly, in my view, was not seeking an easier regulator. And in fact, I think, as you probably already heard from Lawrence, as you said earlier, and others, it actually got a tougher regulator.
Okay. And I hear you, and I just want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly, since, I mean, we have heard from other folks at the OTS that because that was in the press at the time, I mean, the OTS wanted to make the point to Countrywide, hey, look, if you're doing this because you think you're getting an easier regulator, don't bother. I mean, but I'm hearing you saying you don't even remember that coming up as an issue at all.
I don't remember Countrywide ever raising it as an issue. In other words, Countrywide, to my knowledge, never said, we want an easier regulator, or we're looking at OTS because we think you're easier. Now, I believe what you just said, Scott Polakoff told them, that if your reason for conversion is to find an easier regulator, don't bother.
Okay.
But I don't think it was ever an issue that was voiced by Countrywide. I guess something that Scott just wanted to take off the table.
Right.
And that's
right.
Why I said it was insulting when we saw it in the press, and I think even once it was alluded by the OCC, something to that effect.
Now, when you talk about seeing it in the press, do you mean at the time back then, or do you mean, you know, since all the fun stuff started, you know, within the last couple of years?
After it was, shortly after it was approved, around the time period of approval.
Okay, so you are talking the early 07 time frame.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, let me throw out some other reasons we've heard that Countrywide may have sought the thrift charter over the bank charter, and ask you if you've heard about that. But another thing we've heard is that... it appealed to Countrywide because they get one regulator, the OTS, to do the holding company and the thrift, or the Federal Savings Bank, as opposed to both the Fed and the OCC, the two-headed monster, regulating them. Was that an issue that you heard in any of your discussions with Countrywide?
It was clearly an issue that was discussed. Again, I'm not sure it was an issue Countrywide raised. It was more an issue that as OTS had conversations with Countrywide, that was one of the benefits, having a single regulator versus having to deal with two separate regulators.
Mm-hmm. Was or did the OTS, we've heard from others that the OTS, after Mr. Rich became the director of the agency, started outreach programs to make known the benefits of the Thrift Charter. Are you aware of any of those programs, whether they were known as outreach programs or anything else?
I think all OTS directors have done that. And we did do, as part of OTS, when Director Rich was still director, talking points as to the benefits of the Thrift Charter. But I believe other directors have done the same thing in the past. Just got a new life under Director Rich.
So were these talking points, was that like an official document that was, you know, sent out to CEOs of banks?
No, there's, to my knowledge, there was no direct solicitation. There was no marketing as such. But when asked the question, these were talking points as to laying out the benefits. And in fact, it could have been even laid out in some speeches and potentially testimony.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty widely distributed, I believe, within the agency as to if you receive a question about here's some talking points you can use as an answer.
Mm-hmm. Now, was it your understanding that the OTS would, you know, participate in conventions and trade shows and, you know, have a booth where someone could come and get the either the talking points or the glossy brochure saying here are the benefits of the Thrift Charter?
Yep, that was new under the Polakoff Rich administration. We started attending like the OCC and the Fed and the FDIC, the conventions, and actually had a booth. So the OTS had not done that previously, but since the OCC and the Fed and the FDIC had done it routinely, the OTS felt it should be doing that.
And I take it there was some type of written material that was available at those booths?
Yes.
Okay. And is
my memory is it was director's guides, duties and responsibilities for directors.
I remember that.
yeah. There was kind of a little brochure about OTS, who is the OTS. There was probably something in there about benefits of a Thrift Charter.
Is that a separate document or just part of a bigger document, you think?
I think it was like a little insert within the, like a little handout flyer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so tell me, well, wait a minute. Did you ever participate in any of those? I mean, did you ever get the pleasure of manning the booth?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And when were, just generally, where were the trade shows and conventions that where these booths were and where you were participating?
They were in the trade show area, same located, you know, the OCC and the FDIC and the OTS would generally be pretty close together in its booths.
Mm-hmm.
And it was handled out of Washington, D.C., but when it came out to local regions in terms of locations for the conventions, then they would ask local people to participate. And I know I participated in at least two of them.
Do you recall where they were? And
one was in San Francisco. It was the Consumer Convention. One was in Arizona, I believe, Scottsdale.
Okay. And you had mentioned that this was run out of D.C., and you've mentioned Director Rich and Scott Polakoff. Were those, was there any other folks that were running this program out of D.C., to your knowledge?
Joy Burr ran the program. under the direction of Scott Polakoff.
Is that B-U-R-R by any chance?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I suppose you know her title offhand, do you?
No, I don't.
Okay. And she report, and your understanding was that she reported it to Scott Polakoff?
My memory is she reported to Scott Polakoff, although she probably at some point in her career reported up to the communications office.
Okay. So was there an increase in making the benefits of the thrift charter known when Director Rich became director?
Well, an increase compared to...
Before.
What? I mean...
To before he became director. I mean, for example, it sounds like the trade show part of it was...
Clearly, we've not been, as an agency, at the convention trade shows, like the OCC and the FDIC. Mm-hmm. So that was new. That was an increase. I mean, I can tell you under Director Gillerin, the same type of talking points were prepared and used. They just weren't put out in trade shows.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've heard that, you know, from other sources that, you know, when Rich came in, and I think he followed Gillerin, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
But some other folks we've heard from that, you know, under Gillerin, you know, the OTS, you know, was laying people off, and, you know, one individual even termed the OTS as a, you know, a quote-unquote dying agency at the time, and indicated that, you know, Director Rich, who I think this individual thought, you know, had started the outreach program, but apparently that wasn't a start, it was just, you know, doing more, was at least in part in response to that. Do you have any comment on that, whether or not, and that is, you know, was the benefits of the Thrift Charter outreach program an attempt to get more people to switch to a Thrift Charter that would, of course, result in the corresponding increase in the funding base for the agency?
Well, it kind of needs to be kept all in perspective.
Sure.
Clearly, under previous directors, for example, Gillerin, the talking points were prepared, talking points were used for the benefits of the Thrift Charter. The difference was we didn't go to trade shows, we didn't do the public outreach. That happened under the Director Rich administration. So that is clearly a difference. And that was a conscious difference. I have a distinct memory under Gillerin and Riccobono that the decision was made not to put something out that would be seen as marketing. So that was a clear differentiation. Now, Gillerin was laying off people. It was really a budget issue. What Gillerin was doing was putting more people in examination ranks relative to the overall staffing. But he was balancing the budget. He was refusing to use the surplus, really, to run the agency. And as a result, when Director Rich came in, he found an agency that was pretty demoralized and was downsizing substantially. So he began hiring, began authorizing the hiring, even though it was very, in actuality, somewhat uneven and somewhat slow. The number of resources needed varied dramatically around the nation by location. So clearly Rich was trying to revitalize the OTS. And that was done through his chief executives, Scott Polakoff, in principle.
So let me ask you, you mentioned that under Gillerin, I mean, there was a conscious difference under Rich, you know, we were doing these trade shows, and that before, I assume you went under Gillerin, the feeling was, look, we don't want to be marketing the benefits of the thrift charter. Is that a fair assessment of what you just said?
That's That's my recollection.
So, I mean, you were at the OTS back then. What was the thinking on why we don't want to be marketing the benefits of the thrift charter?
It was, like, my recollection is that it was clearly a matter of perception. Even though it happens in one-on-one meetings in terms of the benefit, when people ask you, well, what's the benefit of a thrift charter, you should have an answer. But it was perception. They didn't want to be perceived as an agency out marketing, that institutions needed to make their own decisions. And if they decided they were interested in thrift charter, then you would tell them all about it.
And I hear you saying that, why did they not, I mean, I hear you saying it was an issue of perception, and that the thrift should make their own decision, and then the OTS can answer the question if they ask it. But what was the perception that they were concerned about?
I mean, I'm not sure I was ever told as such, but I have distinct memories of having talking points prepared and offering to have them as a package, and the answer came back, no, it'll look like marketing, and we don't want that perception.
Okay.
I don't know more than that.
Okay. Now, when Mr. Rich came on board and the conscious decision was made to do marketing, in essence, through trade show as another, was there discussion, at least that you were involved in or knew about, hey, you know, there's this perception issue out there, or for any other reasons that we don't want to do this?
My memory is that because the OCC and the FDIC had routinely been doing these types of things, that it wasn't perceived with the same degree of concern. And in fact, you know, looked like the OTS was now just coming of age and joining the other agencies.
Okay. So. Sure, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Tom Stanton. I have a question. In 2003, a photograph appeared of various regulators cutting the red tape. And Mr. Gillerin, who was director at the time, the others were holding shears. Mr. Gillerin was holding a chainsaw. Are you aware of that picture?
I don't think I've seen it. I'm not remembering it.
Okay.
That was it?
I mean, I guess if you had seen it, I was curious what, you know, how it ricocheted in the agency. But if you haven't seen it, then it must not have ricocheted. Okay.
Okay. So
I'm just not recalling that picture.
Okay. Okay, so let's go back now to Countrywide approaching the OTS about switching charters. Let me go back to my notes where we were. And I know you said, you know, Mazzillo told you that he heard from Stan Crisp, you know, why don't you have a thrift charter? He looks into it. A series of meetings, you're at a couple of them. You talked about the OCC, independent appraisal ordering. But just take me through, I guess, generally first on what Countrywide was telling you guys in that meeting, and you had mentioned earlier, and then there were issues. You know, what were the issues with Countrywide, or the potential issues of Countrywide switching to a thrift charter?
I think they ran the gamut. For example, my memory is that one of the meetings was to discuss how the examination process works. In other words, is it a continuous year-round exam, like they were getting from the OCC and the Fed, or would it be a point in time? How many examiners would there be? Do we issue the same type of reports? You know, very basic, almost procedural type questions. Because they wanted to understand if the OTS was different and where it was different, what that meant.
Okay.
Another meeting, I think, dealt with servicing rights. They had huge dollars of servicing rights. And the issue was, along the lines of how does OTS view servicing rights? And is there a strict cap on those rights? The appraisal was one of the issues in one of the meetings. I don't think it was a whole meeting just addressed to the appraisal issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at one time, I think the attorneys went. At one time, John Bowman was there, for example. I'm not remembering exactly what we were told was discussed at those meetings.
Okay, so what...
The meetings I attended were more procedural things. How would the exam work? How would the exam function?
Okay. So were you involved at all in... sort of the due diligence, looking at actually, their financials, the prior OCC reports, the prior Fed reports, getting the handle on what this company was all about. Were you involved in that part of it?
Yes.
Can you at least to start, generally describe what your involvement was?
Well, I do almost nothing about Countrywide. But having come from the LCC, I had a great deal of confidence in the LCC. So we had meetings with the LCC examiners. And actually, throughout the process, worked out a relationship where they started sharing everything. So we, in some ways, unfortunately, placed a great deal of trust and confidence in the LCC's exam ratings and findings, and similarly with the Fed. So we also met with Stan Crisp on numerous occasions, met with his key folks, went through findings. We wanted to make sure there was no issues that in some ways would prompt OTS to say, we just don't want you. And I can remember at the time Scott Polakoff saying, if the OCC is saying they're a one and the Fed is saying they're okay, do we really have any basis not to accept them? The implied answer being no.
Right. So you had mentioned, if I heard you correctly there, that therefore you ended up relying on the OCC and the Fed, and I believe the term you used was perhaps unfortunately. Can you explain what you mean by that, if I heard you correctly?
Well, I have some distinct memories of things that I was surprised at. I was surprised with the asset quality. What we saw versus what the OCC saw in the bank. I was surprised that the Fed never turned a loan file, as it turns out. When we got in there and started looking at some of the holding company stuff, I mean, most of the activities were really done at the holding company level,
mm-hmm.
through the mortgage arm, not in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
So, quite frankly, I was shocked to hear that the Fed was so high level. They basically relied on the internal work of the company.
Let me stop you for a minute and make sure I'm understanding. I take it when you say that you were surprised at these things, this is after the March 12, 2007 approval and the OTS getting in there and doing exams, or is it during the due diligence before the approval order?
It was after they were approved and opening, we were starting our exams.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, I mean, I know we haven't nearly seen close to all the documents, but some of the documents we have seen, for example, that I assume these came to the OTS, they're like supervisory letters. You know how the OCC and the Fed sort of does the targeted exams and then they're rolled up, at the end of the year? Well, you know that from being at the OCC. So I'm looking at a September 8, 2005 Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco letter that, amongst other things, says in here, and of course now I have to find it, on page 2, Countrywide does not have an independent credit review function. If you remember that, great, tell me, but I guess I'm trying to understand, if you were relying on the Fed and the OCC, I take it that meant looking at exam reports and prior supervisory letters and in addition to having meetings with the examiners and other folks. Is that generally accurate?
Yeah, although It was mostly based upon meetings with the EICs and supervisory folks, who would then put color on the memos they'd written and the progress the company had made in the current situation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, a lot of, I would say, the most credence that I remember the agency placing was on the representations by the examiners themselves and what had happened, what was currently an outstanding issue or not an issue that we would need to continue with.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, especially with the Fed, I mean, if you get a 2005 memo, it could be based on 2004 data.
Sure, sure. And things could have changed since then.
It's quite a lengthy process with that.
Right, right. Did anybody at the OCC or the Fed, you know, make any comments like, I'm glad we're getting rid of Countrywide and they're going to be your problem now, or words to that effect?
No one ever described it as a problem that I have memory of. And in fact, I actually asked a couple of the OCC folks if they would entertain staying with Countrywide and coming to the OTS to ensure continuity. And I think they thought about it, but the two I asked definitely decided not to do that.
Do you remember who those?
I didn't get the sense that any of them viewed Countrywide as a problem.
Do you recall who those two were?
It was the OCC EIC I talked to several times.
Is that
going to Wells?
Is that Kim Shearer?
Yes, Kim, and it was also, there is a lead, I believe it was the Answer Quality lead, who moved his family to Long Beach and was doing this huge commute all the way to Calabasas.
Ugh.
A black gentleman.
I don't know, do you know, does the name?
I
don't know the name?
I would probably remember it if somebody said it.
We probably got it somewhere, I just knew Kim's name. I don't know.
But I talked to both of those individuals about when they'd be consider staying.
Right. In fact, hold on a minute. Maybe I have some notes here on who may have been on her exam team. Bear with me. Here we go. Here's some things. Let's see if it was any of these folks. Alex Williams.
This was a guy.
Okay, I mean, I don't know if Alex is male or female, but
I don't know.
How about Manuel Russett?
Don't think so.
Okay, Stan Sorensen.
I'm just not sure now.
That's
but
fine.
I know he lived in Long Beach and was doing the commute. He was the most reluctant to have to relocate his family again. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other male names I have here are Harvey Wright. Doesn't ring a bell?
I'm just not positive.
Or Howard Ratner. Yeah, that's another more. Yeah, I understand. I just was sometimes names jog memory bells. Okay, but in any event, Kim and whoever the asset quality lead was ultimately decided.
So it was the guy. There was the guy in Long Beach.
Right.
We seemed really familiar with him.
Okay, and neither Kim nor the asset quality lead guy from Long Beach or anybody else at the Fed or the OCC ever indicate to you that there were any kind of problems at Countrywide?
Nothing that would indicate that they were happy to get rid of them or that OTS was getting a problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now you were mentioning
They discussed their exam findings.
Right.
But none of that rose to the level of they were having to get rid of them or they were a problem that OTS shouldn't take.
No, and the ratings were what they were. So, I mean, that sort of tells you what they thought overall anyway. I mean, if my recollection is that ones and twos, right? Yeah, is coming into to 07. Okay, so you had mentioned, let's go back to... you had mentioned afterwards, you know, you were surprised with the asset quality, surprised that the Fed never turned a loan file. and then my notes get poor, and but something about how most of the underwriting was being done at the holding company. Tell me, finish that thought. What else were you finding after the OTS approves the charter and is in there looking at both the bank and the holding company?
Well, another area that just sticks in my mind is the internal risk management function was more on paper elaborate versus something that we would necessarily rely upon for down-to-duty work. It's kind of an awkward way of saying that. I mean, high-quality folks in there, but they weren't the type of folks that were going to go in and turn all the files and dig into everything and find all the problems at a deep level. They were very high-level programmatic.
The phrase I sometimes use is they weren't willing to get their hands dirty.
Well, they just weren't set up that way.
Okay.
You know, it coming from the LCC, I mean, in a large organization, you're used to having very robust internal risk management that gets down and turns individual loan files and has a lot of clout on getting things changed and is a confidant of the regulator. Mm-hmm. I always felt the risk management at Countrywide, as we got to know them more, was more of the glossy brochure, but we needed to do our own work.
Mm-hmm. So other than, surprised with the asset, and by the way, I take it when you said you were surprised at the asset quality, you meant that it was worse than you thought it was when you guys, before you approved the charter.
Yes.
Okay. And you mentioned you were surprised that the Fed never turned a loan file. I think I know what that means, but can you explain what that means?
Well, you know, you have all this mortgage activity going on at the holding company.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where most of it's done. And they would make their assessments based on the bank's own quality control reviews and reviewing what the audit found and so forth, versus themselves going in and looking at the loans and seeing what really was going on.
So they were...
That shocked me.
So they were taking internal audit reports, basically.
Internal audit reports, quality assurance reports, and then leveraging them into their own findings. It's kind of a standard hierarchical approach.
Mm-hmm. You know,
top-down supervision.
Right.
The other thing that was hugely different from us and the Feds were they had a consumer issue, and again we had to really force Countrywide to do restitution and deal with the issue. They couldn't believe we were taking the positions we were taking on it.
And I take it that would have been. In Mr. Chow's area, since he was, I think he was the head of compliance back then, too.
Well, the examination folks worked and reported up through Edwin.
Right.
But it was the exam team as a whole. Coach Gray was examined as a team approach.
Mm-hmm.
So Edwin was involved in that. I was involved. The regional director was involved. Washington, D.C. was involved. And we really had to press to get them to step up to the plate on some of the consumer issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, so I hear you telling me about these issues you're finding after the charter gets flipped and they become an OTS shop. I guess, you know, obviously we know from looking at the company that, you know, not long after that, in August of 07, is when Countrywide has the liquidity crisis and B of A invests the $2 billion in the company, and then, of course, by the the following January, B of A announces the acquisition and closes on it, I think a couple quarters later. But I guess I want to get your sense of, you know, sort of high level first of what were the problems at Countrywide that led to their liquidity crisis in August of 07, as you guys saw it?
Well, my recollection is that everybody had a liquidity crisis at that point in time. The secondary markets just absolutely disappeared. And in many ways, Countrywide, given their market presence as the largest, took the brunt of that. But yet, because of their market presence, it actually negotiated some terms that lessened that impact. For example, they'd actually done, my memory is, securitizations to the agencies with no recourse. They negotiated out standard reps and warranties. They had actually lined up backup lines of credit that couldn't be yanked. There was no standard provisions to pull them. So some of those things really were beneficial in getting them through as far as they got before they moved with B of A. But the same token, when the secondary market's crashing, you've got liquidity drying up, you're servicing deposits, everything is starting to just snowball. They were the biggest player. Mm-hmm. They had huge impact as a result. We had to station people from, we actually drew from across the nation, we had to station people there on a constant basis. And also had the Fed people on site there trying to monitor the situation. It was a learning experience for them and for us, and quite frankly, I don't think we'd ever seen in the industry the thing snowball the way they had there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that they had backup lines. If I'm not mistaken, you know, what was happening in August of 07 was the medium-term notes, the commercial paper, and, excuse me, I think the repos are the three areas that they couldn't roll, essentially. And then they drew $11.5 billion over those backup lines. And while you're correct that they had those and they could do that, I think Mr. Mozzillo and just about everybody else in the world, you know, has recognized and has acknowledged that that's not a good signal to send to the markets when you have to draw $11.5 billion off backup lines, because it tells the markets you have a liquidity problem and you're essentially going to the backup lines that the market expects you never have to access. So I hear you saying that, but wasn't that in fact an indicator that, you know, Countrywide was quite different than the other players in the market? Because yeah, August of 07 there was a lot of problems, but at least off the top of my head, don't know of other, you know, companies that one had to draw $11.5 billion from a backup line, and two about a week later have a $2 billion investment from Bank of America. So it seems to me, and what I'm hoping you can do is help me understand, but it seems to me that perhaps the liquidity planning at Countrywide was not what it should have been, given the composition of their assets, and I suspect probably what was in the pipeline.
Clearly, liquidity could have been more robust, and planning could have been far more robust. But at the time, and given historical kind of perspective as to what typically happened in the past, I mean, the backup lines were something that were an abundance of caution, and the fact that they could be drawn under that crisis was a positive. Mm-hmm. You're right that because they were drawn, it also signaled to the market that they were drawing backup lines, and others weren't necessarily, maybe because they didn't have them. They haven't had the foresight. They put it in place so they couldn't be yanked. Mm-hmm. But again, everything's in in perspective. Country Life was the largest. It was the most prominent. All the short sellers were using Countrywide. All the markets were watching. It clearly was the visible image of the liquidity crisis as it snowballed from one type of source to another source.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I mean, we even got down to the stage of the agencies and where that servicing would be yanked and the deposits and what was secure. And so clearly they were under stress, no question about it. And clearly they did not think they would survive for too much longer if things continued without the FAA.
So let me switch gears a little and ask you about their underwriting practices and their loan origination practices and sort of the composition of the portfolio. And let me, you know, again, just sort of tell you what we've seen based on our by no means complete financial analysis of the company. But, of course, one of the things we see with Countrywide that I'm sure will be no surprise to you, both before and then continuing after the OTS becomes the regulator, is, of course, we see the rapid growth. And we see them, you know, being a very large originator overall, I think maybe the largest originator overall, and a very large originator of the non-traditional mortgage product, you know, whether it's the subprime and whether we're measuring that as FICO 620 or 660, whether it's the Alt-A or whether it's the payment option ARM, which I think was particularly increasing towards the end when perhaps other stuff was going down. And so, you know, we see that, and at least with my thinking back to the days of the S&L crisis when I was at the OTS, and just about all I did was look at asset quality, because that's what the issues were back then. It just jumps out to me anyway that to see that kind of growth into that kind of product, I suspect was, you know, something that hit the scoping memo or whatever the OTS used after I left. Maybe there's an annual plan or something in terms of looking at that. So could you just sort of initially anyway tell me what the OTS's concerns were, if any, with the composition of the company's loan portfolio, and not just on book, but, you know, they had this almost $1.5 trillion servicing portfolio. So if you could address those areas and let me know if there were OTS had concerns, and if so, what they were.
Yeah, Lawrence probably has a better memory than I do, than some of the other leads like Salka and Walt. My general recollection is that we were surprised that the asset quality was better, and that the debtors were finding what they were looking at. And that, of course, you are saying that you're absolutely going to be full 20 years. You're not going to walk in day one and really know everything. So every time we start staging a new review, we started learning more and more information. And so, as a result of that, my memory is we put them under a tight business plan, and that I actually asked capital to be increased during that process. And the plan was designed to make them live within parameters, so there wouldn't be big growth spurts, there wouldn't be surprises. And I know we went back and forth quite often, if I remember right, having to reinforce that, no, the business plan is something you have to live with. It's not something that is just there for guidance. So I don't have, I mean, it's been too long, I just don't remember all the specifics of the asset quality. In fact, until you said they grew, I wasn't remembering they were growing during that time period.
All right. Well, let me ask you some specific questions that may jog memory bells or help as soon as I finish writing this last sentence down. Okay. So, do you know if one of the things we're trying to figure out, and that we've seen candidly with some other financial institutions, is different underwriting standards for the loans that go on the book and the loans that go into the servicing portfolio. Do you recall if you guys were seeing that, and or was the OTS even really looking at the underwriting of the loans that were being sold, since they weren't going on the insured institutions or the holding company's books?
I just don't recall with enough specificity to tell you if we saw differences between the what was on the books and what was being securitized or sold.
Okay.
We would have looked at it, is my memory. But again, remember the examination is in cycles.
Right.
And you only do so much at a time, and then you have to bring in people from across the nation to do another piece. So I'm not sure we had enough time to get a full view of that, given what we were trying to concentrate on first in the exams. But again, the exam team would probably have a better memory since they lived with it day in and day out.
Right. So let me ask you something. I think, and maybe Lawrence Carter told me this, and I'm just not remembering it, but when the charter becomes an OT, from the thrift charter, and you guys are in there, is there like a plan for the year developed that says, you know, here's what we plan on looking at, you know, over the next 12 months and sort of the timetable for that?
Yes.
Okay. And then am I correct in assuming that, you know, given that that plan presumably was developed and completed in the March 07 timeframe, since that's when the order got approved, is it true that perhaps that plan was overtaken by events, given that, you know, just 5 months later you're into the August 07 liquidity crisis?
I don't remember exactly when the first RIG plan put in place, but my best guess right now would be it was after the charter approval. That Lawrence would have developed it then. We would have tried to staff it. Would have then tried to go, we went nationwide trying to pull in resources since we were always short in the West. And then figured out what we could do, what we couldn't do, what was more important. And then clearly when liquidity events hit, all the focus shifted to the liquidity events.
Right.
And then when they signed the B of A agreement, the focus shifted to what would happen if it didn't go through.
Right.
And so we kept a lot of pressure in the organization and kept moving forward with them to make sure that they had things happening with capital and otherwise in case the merger didn't happen. So events clearly had an impact on the execution of that supervisory plan.
Okay. And again, I mean, to the extent you recall, do you recall whether or not the examiners or the OTS otherwise ever found that, you know, countrywide, you know, methodology for determining loan loss allowances was deficient and that they were understating reserves, as opposed to the mark, you know, the economy's declining, so you need more reserves?
I'm just not recalling with this.
Okay.
But that would be easily determined but from the work papers.
Right, right, and hopefully from the report. I wouldn't need to go to the work papers.
Well, see, but the other thing is the reports were issued in, over time. And then you end up with the theory would be you end up with an annual roll-up.
Right, right.
So some of those findings could have still been in development.
Right, but like those, I mean, I've seen this with the OCC, and I think I've seen it with the OTS. Too many friggin' regulators, I'm getting them confused. But the OTS did the same thing, right? These interim letters, reports, whatever, they'd get sent to the institution, right? They wouldn't have to wait for the roll-up at the end of the year.
That's correct, but what I'm saying is that there could be communications other than the interim.
Right, right. Right, and those communications not necessarily in writing too. Okay, in I guess one of the things we do see is it looks like on September 28th, 2007, the OTS downgrades countrywide its labeled as an off-site downgrade as opposed to an examination. And then there's an informal action and a board resolution on September 24th and an August 16th, 2007 directive, I think forbidding the company from paying dividends up to the parent. Do you recall the downgrade and those two informal enforcement actions, for lack of a better term?
I didn't before you just mentioned them. I do know that my impression is that we were trying to be forceful with the organization and make sure that they were doing what they needed to be doing throughout this time period, and that some of that would have taken the form of directives. A lot of it took the form of meetings with the boards of directors and with executive management and phone calls.
Generally, do you recall if the OTS took any, you know, other informal action before the liquidity crisis in August of 2007? I haven't seen any, but I'm certainly haven't seen everything, so that's why I ask.
The thing that comes to mind, and again, I don't remember exactly the timing of it, but the consumer issue and right. the capital business plan issue at the bank.
Okay.
I was forcing capital on them when I had more discretion over the organization. I started ratcheting up the capital. I tried to do it through the business plan and otherwise. And before that, they'd kind of been less stringent. They'd been getting less stringent signals from the OTS.
And when you say you had more, I don't know if you said discretion or but what do you mean by that? And that before they were getting...
When I became regional director.
Okay. So and when that occurred, that you're replacing Mr. Finn at that point, is that right?
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
It's hard to keep track of all the players. So explain that to me. Give me some more color on that.
Well, my recollection is that was happening during the crisis, the liquidity events and so forth, and that the organization had received some communication of some temporary ability to lower capital ratios during that crisis with assurances that they would return. And I know when I became regional director, I didn't like that at all. And so I increased the capital benchmarks that they were supposed to reach and be there.
So, I mean, just so I understand it correctly, so at least under Mr. Finn's directorship, the OTS essentially granted Countrywide sort of some temporary capital forbearance?
No, that's
an inaccurate
description. It mischaracterizes.
Okay.
During the liquidity crisis, my memory is that Mozilla asked Finn, who then conferred with Polakoff in D.C., what would happen if the capital ratio fell a little bit as they were struggling with this liquidity issue and they were bringing assets into the bank. And my memory is that Mike, after conferring with Washington, D.C., says there would be some tolerance for a small decline, which I'm not sure ever occurred.
Right.
And then Mike left. And within a few weeks, I changed that.
Okay. So did that small decline mean falling out of capital compliance?
No. Never.
Okay.
Remember, we had them under a business plan. We had them under
right.
injections.
Right. Okay.
But it would have been a small deviation from the plan.
Okay. Now, when they had their liquidity crisis, it sounds like we hear with a lot of these institutions, one of the responses was, give us a 23A and B waiver so we can shove a bunch of assets down in the bank and fund it with easier funding sources. Was that an issue that came up with Countrywide?
Sounds familiar.
I thought it might. So tell me what you recall about that.
Oh man, I'm trying to remember. I have just a general recollection. You might be able to help me refresh it. My recollection is that there's a lot of back and forth on that issue as to what was permissible, what was not permissible, and that OTS Washington Legal got involved in the issue too. I'm just not sure how it all got resolved. I'm just not remembering it.
Yeah, let me, I mean, I don't have anything in front of me to refresh your recollection, but I just know sort of the common fact pattern I've seen in other institutions, and that is the liquidity crisis hits. My understanding is, by the way, that I think a lot of the origination function was going on at the holding company level. So in terms of the pipeline risk, you know, that would have been at the holding company level. And so when the markets freeze up in August of 07 and maybe even a little before then, you know, that's where the risk is. And of course at the holding company, that's probably where, you know, the repos, the medium term notes and the commercial paper is, whereas down in the thrift, you've got those wonderful deposits and those wonderful Federal Home Loan Bank advances. So usually what we've seen, and I'm not saying I saw this in Countrywide, I haven't done the analysis myself, but I suspect what may have happened is that you've got that situation. They want to put the assets into the bank because it's easier funded with deposits and Federal Home Loan Bank advances, but that's an affiliate transaction, and you got to get a waiver or approval from the bank regulator or from the OTS in this case to do that. So, like I said, I don't know that that happened here.
We do see a big increase in assets between June and September.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we
have a big increase between June and September for FHLB advances.
Right. So it appears, just from looking at the public filings, that something like that occurred, unless, of course, I'm wrong and everything was being funded at the bank and they got caught with the pipeline risk and just dealt with it by increasing their FHLB advances. But that's my long-winded way of asking you if that jogs any memory bells.
You know, it sounds generally right. I don't want to get them confused with some other institutions where I know that was the case. I think we had an agreement or an understanding as to their plan, as to when the assets would come into the bank, and that they asked for an acceleration of it. And I think that's then what had triggered them asking if they could get any relief on capital. Mm-hmm. For a temporary basis. So it all sounds right to me, like that was going on.
Right.
I'm just not recalling all the specifics.
Okay. Yeah, all I want is your best recollection. Okay, let me... I forgot to ask you this earlier, but you had mentioned earlier that after the OTS became the regulator, that you found some surprises, and they weren't good surprises from the OTS perspective, worse asset quality and the other things. Did you or anyone else at the OTS ever go back to the OCC and the Fed and say, what's up, guys? You know, we're finding a lot more problems here than your exam reports, supervisory letters, and verbal representations indicated?
I don't remember doing that because I thought at the time it would just sound like sour grapes. But I think, now that I sit here, I think that's a comment we as an agency made. When I say that, I think that's a comment that may have been made in Washington.
And when you say it was a comment made for the FCIC folk wanting to put their grubby little fingers on a document that shows that, like in a testimony or a press release or...
No. It would have been a meeting. Let me just... I'll think about that for a minute as you ask me another question. I'm trying to... Because I know that statement has been made. It just wasn't, I don't think it was made at that time, but I know it's been made subsequent to that time.
Okay, and when you say at that time, as a, and,
at the September 2007, you know, late 2007 time period.
Okay.
I don't think it was made at that time. I think it was made subsequent in some comments, probably in the late 2008, 2009 time period.
And understanding your recollection's hazy, but and because you think it's in late 2008, early 2000.
I think it was in response to GAO or one of those. There's something out there where the agency was questioned.
Okay.
And I think again, publicly, the exam ratings couldn't be discussed. Mm-hmm. But I think among the regulators, there was a comment made.
Mm-hmm. I don't suppose you know Mr. Sturbins, do you?
Not me. Sorry.
Okay. Of course, you now know that. I mean, we'll obviously do our if it's public document and geo thing, we'll find it. But Chris, if you can, if you guys could put that on your list of stuff to get to us, if it's something that would be helpful.
The more I think about this, I think Polakoff said this somewhere.
Okay. Were there, I mean, boy, I'm really going to show my ignorance here. I know there have been lawsuits and hearings on Countrywide. I don't know if those hearings have, you know, focused on the regulation of Countrywide. And I'm looking around the table here to see if my guys know. And they don't. But do you know Mr. Doko? And you know, Chris, I'm going to let you answer this one too if you know.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I've not talked to anybody about Countrywide, I don't think.
Okay. Okay. Let me look at my notes here.
While Chris is looking, I have a question about your tight business plan, please, that you said with increasing capital was imposed before August of 2007. What was Mr. Mazzillo's reaction to that?
I don't remember a reaction from Mazzillo. Carlos was the one we were dealing primarily with, and then David Sample.
And what was their reaction? I mean, I can imagine.
Carlos was didn't like it, but understood. We have to keep selling it to Dave.
So there was no concern about being required to increase capital.
Do this downgrade in September of 07, at least according to my notes here, I don't have it in front of me, but asset quality was still rated a 2, which was what it was rated.
I guess it was rated
a 1 before by the OCC when you guys took it over. So I guess, but let me ask you this, do you recall any discussion in the September 2007 time frame about these ratings, and you know, were there any internal disagreements on what the ratings should be? I know there's always discussions, you know, about what they should be, but did folks think that the ratings should be worse?
I don't remember any internal disagreements about the ratings, but again, I think the ratings were done in stages,
mm-hmm.
and I think things were in process at the exam, and so Lawrence probably would remember best, but I'm not sure we had asset quality finished at that time. So in terms of knowing more to change that rating even worse than it was. What happens is you go through the exam, you get a sense of what's going on, you get some interim findings, but you're not finished. And so you do an interim rating based on what you know at that time, but you haven't fully concluded everything.
Mm-hmm. What about, were there any disagreements with the and I don't mean just September of 07, but at any time that you guys, the OTS was regulating and rating countrywide, were there any disagreements with the FDIC on the ratings?
I don't know, I recall sitting here, but then again, I just don't have a memory of that.
And I'm sorry, I just didn't hear. You do not recall whether or not there were?
Not that I recall, but I don't have a good memory of that. I'm not even remembering the FDIC's involvement to speak of.
Okay.
What about at the end of 07 and early 2008? The information we have says there were rating disagreements.
With the FDIC?
Between the OTS and the FDIC. Specifically, as a result of the December 12, 2000 letter that wrapped the first two quarterly visitations, where the ratings that were assigned was a 2 for capital, 3 for asset quality, 2 for management, 3 for earnings, 3 for liquidity, 2 for sensitivity, and a 3 composite. The difference is essentially is that one agency wanted to rate it harsher than the 12-1207 OTS ratings. So we wanted to...
Was it a difference in composites or a difference in component?
Well, I just wanted to ask whether do you recall any discussion about differences, rating disagreements, differences in general?
You know, if there were, I would have been involved. I'm just not recalling them with regards to Countrywide. I'm not remember them sitting here today.
Okay.
I never really thought about this for 2 years. So. But if we had disagreements, it would have. Yes, there would have been discussions.
I'm sure. Okay. Let me. Did the OTS ever considered taking any enforcement action against Countrywide other than these two informal ones that I mentioned earlier, the dividend directive and the board resolution to maintain capital? But I mean, any formal enforcement action, supervisory agreement, cease and desist order, et cetera.
The record would show, but my general recollection is those things would have been discussed. But I think what happened was the B of A and the other stuff overtook those discussions.
Mm-hmm. Let me just look at my notes here. I think we're getting close.
Hi, it's Carl McBurn. One of the things you mentioned earlier was that the OTS had done certain things to just in case the Bank of America merger didn't take place. Could you kind of outlay what some of those activities were?
If I could remember them, I would. I just know that we did a whole series of things. I think the business plan, sticking to the business plan, was one of them. I know we had regular meetings with Bank of America folks. I know
Do you remember who at Bank of America? You?
It was the lady that was put in charge. The top person who now. They even got a promotion afterwards, I think.
But you don't
remember. Barbara somebody?
Okay. So putting in place the business, making sure they stick to the business plan, what else was kind of...
Yeah, I'm just not recalling it, but I know there's a series of things that we were doing during that transitional time period so that we wouldn't be flat-footed and they wouldn't be caught flat-footed if the acquisition fell through.
Was it of your opinion that they could have survived without the acquisition? Did you guys ever opine on that, or...?
I'm not sure we ever had that discussion. But there clearly we had concern.
Did you, in your meetings with Bank of America, how, you know, I've seen press that, you know, all during that year that they felt that maybe Bank of America would walk away. How real did you feel that threat was?
We actually were receiving the exact opposite messages from Bank of America directly. We would see that in the press. We'd see the speculation among analysts and so forth. And that's why, you know, conversations were held. I think the Washington, D.C. folks actually talked directly to the CEO of Bank of America. And then on the regional level, I would meet with the transitional chief in Calabasas. And we would get just the opposite from them. It was, no, we're committed, we're going forward, we're not worried about that, you know, this is what we're doing.
And this transitional chief, this is the Barbara, the person's name you can't recall right now, or is this another person?
No, the transitional person there was, I think it was Barbara, I think her name was Barbara. And she later became, when Sample got ousted, she became the top person there. Then subsequently is like for BAC over like all the mortgages are all in London now.
You had mentioned earlier when we were talking about whether Countrywide was perhaps looking to go to a thrift charter because the OTS was an easier regulator. And you had mentioned that, you know, that was insulting, and that you even heard the OCC make comments like that. And I, of course, forgot to follow up and ask you who at the OCC made comments like that and when.
It was in a press report. The OTS would circulate internal news. Yeah, every day you'd pick up whatever was on the news and would circulate throughout, so the examiners never would keep informed. Mm-hmm. I saw a reference, and I remember a reference to that coming from the OCC.
And do you remember the timing of that at all?
Early press reports. Yeah, I'm just not going to say.
Was it after the approval, after they flipped charters?
Yeah, it was afterwards. It was after we'd already had them.
Okay. So
I remember internally, I mean, I have this memory of internally us looking at each other and said, God, and they're the ones that ran number one.
Fine. I mean, if it was in the press clippings packet, then we should be able to find it by just simply doing a search. But again, that's why I want it. But to make that search easier, I've seen if I can probe you a little on timing. Was it after they flipped charters, but before the liquidity crisis in August?
It's during the time period that all the discussion was going on about why would they flip? And was a, you know, there was during all that time period where it was, you know, OTS flipped because OTS was an easier regulator.
Okay. So it sounds like then definitely before the liquidity crisis in August of 2007.
That sounds correct.
Right. And maybe even before the it got approved. Well, we'll find out anyway.
Maybe, but I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, Daryl, the March 5th, 2007 OTS order that's on the public website mentioned that there was a commenter, because this goes out for public comment, and there was a commenter that, and I'll quote, that expressed concern about the level of non-traditional adjustable rate mortgages originated by the holding company's affiliate and the potential impact of an economic downturn on such mortgages in the commenter's local market and on the institution's financial position. So this is something that came in as a result of their December 2006 application with the OTS. Was there ever any internal discussion in your capacity, in your role, as to the level of payment option arms in relation to Countrywide's capital and the bearing that might have on the condition of the bank and the holding company?
During this time period, there was regular discussions and benchmarking among institutions for non-traditional mortgages by type of non-traditional mortgage. In other words, IOs, interest-only, pay options, and so forth. And so getting access to the Countrywide data was one of the things that benefited the OTS in terms of getting that information. So there was constantly, every institution was looked at in terms of volumes, characteristics, in relationship to its capital, its underwriting standards, its risk management. That was done on about a quarterly basis, just across the spectrum of thrifts.
So let me ask you, Mr. Doko, I mean, given the comments you've made about you know, what you found in terms of asset quality and other issues after they became a federal savings bank and you guys went in there, I mean, if nothing else, at least with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, should the OTS have done more independent due diligence Countrywide instead of just relying on the OCC and the Fed?
I don't think so. I mean, hindsight's great. I could easily say I wish we had done more. But from a matter of public policy, when you have bank regulators and holding company regulators who are perceived as top-notch, and you say you're not going to rely on them, I'm not sure that's good public policy. So I don't second-guess the decision of the decision-makers in Washington for relying on the other regulators.
Okay.
I mean, clearly there were a series of meetings, remember, where we were trying to assess them, OTS was trying to assess them, they were trying to assess OTS. Clearly there was conversations with the other regulators. Clearly there was a sharing of the other regulators' findings. There was meetings on the ground level between the examiners. I mean, there was a fair amount done, but we did trust, and as a general rule, I think you should trust the other regulators in terms of exam findings.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tom, did you?
You had mentioned earlier that you had to push on consumer issues.
Yes.
What kind of consumer issues concerned you?
The documents will show it. I'm just not remembering all the specifics, but we had to push a lot to get them to do restitution. You got to take all this with kind of the haziness of my memory. They were willing, if I remember right, to do restitution on an individual loan where it was found to be acquired, but they weren't willing initially to go back and then apply that to all the other loans that could be similarly situated.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the OCC never required them to. And so they were shocked that we were required to go back and deal with the whole population. And I remember Sandy Samuels, their general counsel, raising this issue all the way to Washington, D.C., us going back and forth, them getting I think they got an independent legal opinion and everything else, and we just had to push them to get to do it. And the bottom line was, they had to do it.
Okay, thanks.
So, Mr. Doko, I'll ask you, this is my last question, is the question I ask everybody at the end of these interviews, and it's similar to sort of, but broader than the one about should you have relied on the Fed and the OCC in terms of the due diligence. But now that you've had a chance to look back on it, tell me if you believe, you know, the OTS anyway, you know, any mistakes made, lessons learned when it comes to the regulation of Countrywide. And believe me, I understand that you guys got them fairly late in the game.
Well, there's been a lot of lessons learned throughout this time period. I think for a matter of bigger picture policy issues, the one thing I would state is agencies with limited resources have a hard time gearing up for big challenges. And in the case of Countrywide, it was a huge organization. We were doing our best, but we were an agency with limited resources. And numbers don't give you the story. It's the quality of the resources. And so, I mean, we had Washington Mutual, we had IndyMac, we had all the other big California thrifts. Got the big ones in the east. And net result was that our core experts in terms of field examiners and so forth were stretched. And so the agency, in hindsight, could have been better positioned for taking on that type of challenge. I think that's one of the lessons that has not been talked about, but was a clear lesson for us. Another one is when you get too close to an industry, in terms of you get used to the types of products that originates, non-traditional mortgages, interest-only, pay option, negative AM, they don't become so shocking when you hear them because you see them in other institutions. I think that's a lesson that sometimes when you get to know a product, you sometimes give it too much credence. You base too much on historical facts where, you know, other institutions have done it for 20 years and it's not been a problem. It's like, you know, things change in the future and there's always something new and different that you just don't think about at the time. So when the liquidity crisis hit, when the, you know, subprime and the credit quality started showing up, it just snowballed to all the other products and everything shut down. And you get Fannie and Freddie underwriting with weaker standards, quite frankly, than the banks. The whole thing, it's hard to keep in perspective because you're seeing bits and pieces. You're not doing that systemic review, which is now part of the new legislation, I guess. But I think that's a lesson. It's a lesson that you can't get too close without knowing you're getting too close because you see the products. You see historically that other institutions have done well with them. So it's a tough thing to admit, but I think it's true.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Well, obviously, agency policy, you know, securitizations. You looked at recourse liability, but you didn't spend as much time looking at what was sold, especially if it was sold to an agency, because you thought it was gone, and recourse was limited to standard reps and warranties. I think those are lessons that have already been addressed by the regulators and some recent guidance and so forth.
Right, right. But just, I want to make sure I understand that third one. I mean, I think I understand what you mean, given that I used to be a bank examiner, and that is if I'm looking at loans that are being sold without recourse and the only way they come back is if there's a rep and warranty violation, which usually just means it's an out-and-out fraudulent loan, I'm not so concerned about what's going on with those loans. I'm concerned about the loans that go on the books. Is that what you meant?
Yes.
Right.
Yes,
whereas, you know, sort of a broader perspective of if it's a crap loan, it's a crap loan, and we should be concerned about it wherever it ends up.
especially when the markets act like they do with liquidity.
Right.
Where they don't differentiate.
Okay. Mr. Doko, thank you very much for your time. We very much appreciate it. I'll also tell you what I tell everybody. You know, we'll go over our notes, talks amongst ourselves. We figure out we forgot to ask you something, we'll call, you know, Mark Hinkson or Chris and you know, get you on the phone for a couple of minutes if necessary. But I don't think that will be necessary.
Okay. Well, I hope this was somewhat helpful. My memory's vague on this. I hadn't really thought about it for a couple of years, but I'm glad to help you any way I can.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.